Thank you for listening. This is the Legends Podcast by All Day Vinyl, and I'm your host, Scott Duddleson. After you finish this episode, please subscribe, rate, and check us out on Instagram and YouTube at All Day Vinyl. Today, I'm excited to speak with a legend and arguably one of the greatest guitarists and songwriters in rock and roll history via his work as a founding member of The Doors. Over the last 40 years, this gentleman has put out instrumental albums that have showcased his unique and unmistakable guitar sound, and most recently released the debut album from his jazz funk instrumental group, The Soul Savages. He's also released his autobiography, Set the Night on Fire, detailing his life and career with The Doors and beyond. I'm pleased to introduce to you Robbie Krieger. Robbie, thank you for joining.
Hello, hello.
So thank you for coming. I want to start by talking about Soul Savages, and I'll just frame it a little for the audience. The Soul Savages includes Ed Roth, who's played with Sugar Otis, Ronnie Montrose, plays with you and your solo band, does the keys. Has Franklin Vanderbilt on drums. Franklin's played with Lenny Kravitz for a long time, has his own solo stuff as well. And Kevin Brandino, who's played with Mary J. Blige, Justin Timberlake.
Aretha Franklin.
So many great musicians. So tell me how y'all came together.
Well, you know, I built the studio about 6 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago. And a couple of musicians happened to live nearby, Ed Roth being one of them, and Kevin Brandon also lives nearby. And I had played on various projects with Kevin in the past, so I knew Kevin. And then I started working with Ed, and he happened to know Kevin as well. So, and poor Kevin was sick for a while. He almost died, in fact. But he got through it, and he's back. And so we wanted to help him out and get him back into music again. And we did. So we started playing. This was during the pandemic. And we started, you know, just jamming together and writing songs and stuff. And then Kevin happened to know Franklin Vanderbilt, and he got him involved. And that's pretty much how it got started.
And the music is, I would describe it as jazz funk. And I also feel, I hear a little Booker T and the MGs in there, that R&B and that soul. And when y'all got together, was that the type of sound that was emanating, or is this something that had evolved into this jazzy funk role?
Well, I mean, we didn't really have anything in mind, you know. We're just playing, let's play, you know, and see what happened. And this is just kind of what came out of it, you know. So, and I think that's really a cool way to write stuff, you know. So, and that's one reason why we divided the writing up four ways equally. You know, even though on some songs, you know, I might have written a melody or Ed, or, but we divided everything four ways, the same as The Doors, in fact. And really, I think that's the best way for a band to write music. You know, so it was very, very spontaneous. There was no real thought behind it, you know. There was a couple songs, like, on the one song where I play the sitar, you know, that's really a Ravi Shankar lick that I kind of stole, and we all just kind of came in on that. And, you know, so there's a million different ways that we write songs, but overall, I would say spontaneous is the best word to use.
And I always wondered, an instrumental song, way back from Booker T and the MGs, and now I'm going to ask you around this, how do you go about naming these? You know, it's easy for Light My Fire. It's easy for Lover Madly. How do you come up with Ricochet Rabbit or Samosa as in Kingfisher?
Well, you know, Marco, who's our engineer and studio manager, he's really good at that. He would write down like 100 different names for a song, and we would all pick the best one.
And you know, you've done so many instrumental albums, though. Is that going back in history? Would it be that kind of randomness? Somebody would throw out names, or does it inspire when you're creating these riffs, creating the songs?
Yeah, it's not easy to name instrumental songs because, like you say, there's no words. So you just have to think, okay, what does this remind me of? Or I don't know. That's a good question. But, you know, we never fail to come up with a name.
Yeah, got to come up with something. And, I love the electric sitar that's in there. And that harkens back, obviously, to the influences which drew you early in music, Ravi Shankar. And the slide guitar is obviously also very important in it. And, you know, we're going to talk about the book in a little bit. But in the book, you do mention how you used to break off the bottlenecks, and that would be the slide. And that was, have you broken off any bottlenecks in recent years?
Not lately, you know. Usually, you know, back in the day, they didn't have any slides that you could buy at the guitar store. So you had to make your own. And I would break the neck off of a wine bottle. Usually they were the best. The best ones were actually from cheap California champagne bottles. Cold Duck was a good one. And I would leave the edge of it jagged, you know. Because, you know, some of the places we played, it might be a good weapon if I needed it.
That's absolutely right. I wonder if those wine bottles are still as good. And when you play, going back, well, first of all, are you guys going to be touring? I've seen you play in LA 5, 6, 7 times. Is there going to be any shows outside for other folks?
I hope so. We're hoping. Trying to get the record played, you know, on radio, and we've gotten quite a few plays already, mostly in Europe, unfortunately, but also back east. And you know, if we can get some good radio play, that'll help us get some gigs. You know, looking to get some jazz festival.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, I want to get Monterey Jazz Festival. Would be nice.
Amazing. I've heard all your solo albums, or at least I've heard most of your solo albums, and I think this is the best of all of them.
Really?
It's true. I really, really like it. Really like it. And I've seen you play it. I've seen you play it live, and it's groovy and it's funky, super solid. And when you do play it, you add, if I recall, there's two Doors-related songs you'll do. You'll do Backdoor Man and you'll do Ghost Song. Backdoor Man, you've noted, is one of the earliest songs from the Doors repertoire. And you do Freeway Jam, which we'll talk about Phil Chen as well. But talk real quick about Backdoor Man and that song, what it means to the history of the Doors and why you brought it back for the Soul Savages.
Well, you know, Backdoor Man was Willie Dixon. I mean, actually, Willie Dixon wrote it, but I think the first guy that recorded it was Howlin' Wolf, I think. Yeah, Howlin' Wolf. And he did this version, which was really nothing like our version. The guy who I heard do it was John Hammond.
Yeah.
Do you know who he is, John Hammond Jr.?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, his dad was the CEO of Columbia Records, and he signed Bob Dylan and all these people. So his son was really into blues, and he plays guitar and sings, and he's probably the best Robert Johnson clone I've ever seen. And, you know, which is pretty amazing. White guy, you know, but he just nails it, you know. And I played with him one time at a festival in Sacramento. And I told him, hey, you know, the Doors did your version of Backdoor Man. He didn't even know. he didn't even realize. Because his version is so different than Howlin' Wolf. You know, Howlin' Wolf is, see, how did that go? Backdoor Man. Backdoor Man. You know, it didn't have that beat, that dunk, 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 dunk. Which I loved, you know. I thought that was really great. And I showed it to the Doors, and and that's when we started doing it. This is when we didn't have enough original songs, you know, and we needed to come up with some cover song. That was on our first Doors album. So that shows you how good it was. I always thought it could have been a single myself.
One of the songs you play live is Freeway Jam, which was from the Jeff Beck album, Blow by Blow, which the original album on Blow by Blow featured Phil Chen on bass. And I know you play this as a tribute to Phil. Phil was a longtime bandmate from your solo band and also from your days with the Butts Band. Maybe you could talk a little about Phil and the experience with the Butts Band.
Yeah, Phil Chen was just an amazing bass player, and he was from Jamaica. And I met him in England in the early 70s. And he was like session guy in England at the time, and also a reggae guy. He came over to England from Jamaica with a band, a reggae band. Reggae was popular in England much earlier than in the United States.
Right.
So anyway, we met Phil, and John Densmore and I were over there at, you know, the Doors were pretty much done. You know, Ray wanted to try something else by that time. We had done two albums as the Doors without Jim. And so we decided to go, let's everybody go to England and we'll find a singer maybe, you know. Well, that didn't work out. So John and I were left over there in England, and we decided to form another band. So we met this guy, Jess Roden, and we formed a band called the Butts Band. Don't ask me why, but that was a pretty weird name. Anyway, he knew Phil Chen, and he invited him to come and you know, play with us. And Phil dug the stuff we were doing, and he joined the band. So now we decided to record half of the album in England and half of it in Jamaica. And Phil loved that because he hadn't seen his dad for years, you know. And he loved the idea of going back to Jamaica and one last time at least, you know. And so after that, we all came back to L.A. and we tried to get this band going, the Butts Band, and just never got off the ground. The album came out, but didn't really do well enough to get enough gigs, you know. So, but I kept in touch with Phil all the next 30, 40 years, and he ended up playing with Ray Manzarek and I back in 2000 when we got the Doors back together to play Doors music. And Phil was just a great guy, you know, everybody loved him, and we still talk about him all the time. Anyway, he played on Blow by Blow album with Jeff Beck. That was in the early 70s. And he played on Freeway Jam. So when Jeff Beck died, Ed and I and the other guys decided, hey, let's do Freeway Jam, and we'll dedicate it to those guys, you know.
Amazing. Great version. And happy, you know, you keep Phil's spirit alive. I got to know Phil a little through your events that you would do in Thousand Oaks. And I would see him every year, and he's always just wonderful. I could hear his voice, just such a wonderful man. So I love that spirit.
That Jamaican accent that he never lost, you know.
Yeah.
So cool. He was really a funny guy too. He always gave people nicknames.
What was your nickname?
My nickname was the Worm.
The Worm.
A worm. It's a long story, but I guess I'll tell it to you real quick.
Yeah, do it.
When we were getting the Butts Band off the ground, we were going to be on Elektra Records, and all of a sudden, Elektra got bought by Warner's, and God, who was that guy? the shit, I can't remember his name. That's
is a musician.
No, he was the president of Elektra. He's a real annoying person. He's like anyway, the guy, you know, he says, okay, we recorded the whole album, right? In Jamaica and London, and Bruce Botnick had engineered it and produced it with us. And we really liked it, you know. So we had a meeting with this guy, I'll remember his name in a minute. And he says, well, you know, this is good, but I think you should recut the album. And I must have had this horrible look on my face at that point. And he goes, wow, you look like you just swallowed a worm or something. I said, you're right. I said, I don't want any part of that, you know, even though, you know, he was going to get us this great producer and stuff. But, you know, we'd already done the damn thing and we liked it, you know, didn't want to redo it.
Right.
So Phil, I told Phil about that and he said, okay, you're the worm.
Would he call you that throughout the next 35, 40 years?
Yeah.
Love it.
Exactly. And then he even called my son Wormsy. Waylon is our little worm.
I love it. And you got so many great stories, and you recount a lot of them in the book you just wrote, Set the Night on Fire. And yeah. I loved it. And I've read the Danny Sugarman book, I've read John's book, I've read this book, and I love them all. But I love particularly the humor and some of the self-effacingness. Like, there's a humility and a humor that's in your book that I didn't feel in any others. In creating this book, I know you went out and you went to the Doors fans and you recollected a lot of material, but did you keep material over the years, any diaries, any scraps that help you fill in these gaps?
No, I really didn't. I'm really terrible at that, about that. I didn't keep a lot of pictures, luckily, but I did have my co-writer guy, Jeff Aloulis, who was really good at looking up and finding all this stuff. He made friends with all these Doors freaks, you know, these guys who knew everything about the Doors and more than I did, more than I had forgotten, you know. So that was a very helpful, Jeff Aloulis.
And you allude to the fact that there are a lot of books about the Doors, and there's a lot of mythology, whether it's from the movie or elsewhere, that's been built, a lot of which isn't true, but it's grown into, I think it's true. Is there anything that you had previously bought into as being true, but after sourcing feedback or other recollections, you realized you were actually molded in by this mythology?
In the movie, there's a number of things I kind of almost believed, you know, that never happened. Like that, you know, he shows Jim lighting Pam on fire in the bathroom. You know, that never happened, at least as far as I know. You know, stuff like that. Yeah, the movie was very loose as far as being truthful.
Yeah, I saw the movie. You know, you dedicate part of the book to the movie and talk about it. And from my perspective, I think I was 12 when that movie came out, and I didn't know a lot about the Doors. Maybe I'd heard some of the music, but not really connecting that it was the Doors. And I saw that film at 12, and it was definitely very, very interesting. And I learned a lot from that. And it really opened my eyes, not only to the Doors, but to music and that era. And I feel like a lot of kids and a lot of people of my generation, that's what that film did. And you note that one of the issues that you had with the film was it didn't portray Jim's humility as well as it should, and just really focused on the over-the-topness. Is there any anecdote or anything you could share about that humility that fills it in?
Well, I mean, he did a lot of weird stuff like I tell in the book. The first chapter is when I talk about the you know, he jumped out the window and we had to grab him, bring him back. And then he started humping me, you know. And then, but then the next day when we confronted him about it, he would say, you know, he would just be so, you know, he didn't even remember it, you know. So how can you blame him, you know? And he would just be a totally different guy, you know. I mean, it was pretty scary almost, you know. So yeah, I would say the day after, that was the real Jim.
Yeah. And you talk a lot about, obviously, the self-destruction in the book of Jim, but you also talk about years later, the self-destruction with yourself and the drugs that you got into and that period of recovery. Was it, and that wasn't very well known, what I understand, until you really unveiled it in the book. Was it a challenge to really look at the destruction that Jim had and then also writing about the destruction that it caused in your life at the time as well?
Well, it was different, I think, because, you know, Jim really was manic depressive. You know, I think that's what they would call him these days. We're walking through my house now.
Yeah, thank you.
Manic depression, you know, you're really two different people. Or, you know, and some people make it have three or four, you know, different personalities or more. But, you know, I think with me, it was just, I never really wanted to be in the limelight. You know, I always wanted to be in the background. Jim was up in front, you know. So I think, you know, when I had to be the front man, then that put the pressure on. And I think that's more like the reason I got into the drugs. And all my friends, I don't know why, but everybody I knew was into drugs during the 80s and 90s. It was just the thing to do, I guess. I don't know.
Well, we're lucky now that there's support systems in place for people to get the help that they need that may not have been in place in the 60s.
Yeah, we didn't have, you know, we had Betty Ford. That was about it.
Yeah. And what I also found very interesting in the book is, and the role of your father as a hero, and he comes across as the hero of the band a lot, whether it's getting your first contracts or helping get the first lawyer, recommend you get a criminal attorney as well. And then also staging an intervention with Jim, which seems to be totally unique to that time and very progressive and forward thing.
Yeah, that was unusual. You know, my dad was he went to a shrink for I don't know how long, as long as I can remember, which was pretty unusual in those days, you know. And so maybe, yeah, I guess he must have had some issues himself, you know, growing up or whatever. His parents were kind of weird. His grandfather was a chronic gambler. I mean, his dad was a chronic gambler, and he used to gamble with the Warner Brothers.
Oh, wow. He'd
play cards with them. He lost like millions of dollars of his wife's money. My poor grandma, she never quite got over that. You know, she came from a rich family. Have you ever heard of Rotter right. Shoes?
No, I haven't.
Well, you've heard of, gosh, all the big shoe companies used to buy their stuff from Rotter.
Okay.
Back east. Back in Pittsburgh at the time. So that, you know, they were, you know, when I say he lost millions, that was like billions today, you know. So that was pretty kind of weird.
A few questions from the audience here.
Okay. Right. David Geffen, that was the guy from the Warner Brothers.
David Geffen is well known, and the legend is he is pretty annoying. Okay, let me ask you my daughter's question real quick.
Okay.
What, can you read this question for me? What is the question?
How does it feel when you release a new album?
How does it feel when you release a new album?
Oh, it feels great. Feels like you just had a baby.
Ooh, very nice. I think Elsie, who both one day wants to have a baby, now probably wants to release her own album. That's it. All right. So thank you, Robbie. Thank you for taking the time to chat. Let me take a few questions from the audience here.
Okay. So
the first question is from Ben McFarlane. And the question is, what is your favorite Doors song and Doors album?
Oh, boy. You know, it changes over time, but lately I think L.A. Woman album and song.
Love it.
Pretty up there.
Up there, yeah. All right, this one's from Gautos. And his question for you is, who is your favorite flamenco guitarist?
Well, I really like Sabikas because he's probably the most technically great flamenco guy. But at Escudero, he was really good too. I like his the way he plays.
Is there any seminal flamenco album that audience and myself included? I don't know a lot of flamenco should start with.
Jeez. Well, the first one I heard, my dad had this album in our den growing up. It was called Dos Flamencos. And I don't even remember who the guys were, but if you could ever find that album, it was really good. It was two guys playing flamenco at the same time. And that's what inspired my friend Billy Wolf and I to start playing flamenco.
Amazing. This question is from Haverguy. And the question is essentially this. How do you approach and sustain long creative and personal relationships? And he mentions, you know, throughout Ray's life, you had this both business and personal relationship and musical relationship where you played. And you've been famously married for 50 years, which is a very amazing, incredible thing. Like, what are the keys to sustaining, you know, these types of relationships?
Jeez, that's a good question. I don't know. I think, you know, I kind of learned it from my parents who stayed together all their lives. And, you know, I think you learn from your parents pretty much.
All right. And then this question is from David Lewandowski. I'm actually very curious on this one, too. You've played with so many singers that have sung Jim songs. I've seen you play with a whole host of them. Are there any that have really, over the last 50 years, that have stood out that you've played with through on stage, you're thinking, this is badass?
Oh, God, there's a lot of them.
Or any of them. Yeah, if there's a few, that's great. Yeah.
Eric Burden was pretty cool. I played with him on and off for a number of years, and we would do, you know, some of his songs, some of my songs, and because he was a hero of ours, you know, we really loved the Animals, and we, you know, they had the same instruments as us, you know, the organ and the guitar, so that was pretty cool. Ian Astbury was very good. You know, he's the first guy that played with Ray and I when we got back together with Phil Chen in 2000. He was really, you know, he didn't sing like Jim especially, but he had the vibe down, you know.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of guys who are really good. Dave Brock is really good at doing Jim. Millie Matijevich from Steelheart is very good. Brett Scallions from Fuel.
Mm-hmm.
It's too many to mention.
Yeah. I just saw you play with Brett a few weeks ago in Agora.
Right. Right.
Very great. And I've got one last question for you, and I'm going to tie the Doors back with the Soul Savages. And this question is about American Prayer. And in your sets, you play Ghost Song. That's a part of it. And that was on the American Prayer. The question was about how American Prayer came together. And then I'm curious why Ghost Song into the Soul Savages set.
you know, Jim had had Jim wanted to do a poetry album, and he wanted to have classical music behind it for some reason. So he hired this guy, John Haney, who was a friend of ours, to produce it. And he got this guy, this classical guy, I forget his name, to do the music. But unfortunately, Jim passed away before the music could be done. And I often wonder if the guy has any of that music still in his archives, or if he's still alive. I don't even know. But anyway, so this was about 10 years goes by, and you know, we heard the poetry, and it was very cool, but we didn't think about even doing music to it. And then one time, about 10 years later, I ran into John Haney, and I said, "Hey, John, do you still have that poetry that Jim recorded?" And he said, yeah. He gave me a copy. And after listening to it, I had the idea to put music. We should do it, you know. Who better? You know, why let some classical guy who probably never even heard the Doors, you know, put music to this stuff? And, you know, because really that's what we were used to doing, was putting music to Jim's poetry. So we did it, and it came out great. It's one of my favorite albums that we've done.
It's pretty amazing. And why the inclusion of Ghost Song with the Soul Savage?
Well, the Ghost Song, I don't know why, but we started playing it with the Doors group. I wasn't thinking of it for the Soul Savages, but we started doing it with the Doors band for maybe it was a anniversary of the album or something like that. So we decided to start doing that song. And then it seemed to, you know, we're always looking for some kind of Doors song to sneak into the Soul Savages because, you know, let's face it, people want to hear the Doors when they come to see me play, no matter what. So, you know, we don't do Light My Fire or any of the normal Doors songs, but, you know, deep cuts are okay. Yeah. So we decided, okay, let's do this. And it comes out pretty good, I think.
Yeah, it's such a funky song. Great bass line, great groove. Very great. Well, Robbie, thank you so much for the time. Thank you for everything you've contributed to music history. Thank you for the new music. We've been listening to it quite a bit. I'll see you hopefully soon at a show.
And yeah.
Maybe do this again in the future.
All right. I think we'll be at Bogey's pretty soon.
All right. I'll see you there.
Okay. Bye, right, guys.
Thank you, Robbie. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Legends Podcast by All Day Vinyl. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate it, share it, subscribe, and follow us and check us out at All Day Vinyl on Instagram and YouTube.